It is a great privilege for me to introduce to you Dr. Gerald Winslow. Dr. Winslow is the director of the Department of Ethics at Loma Linda University. He is the vice president in the medical center, where they have seen fit to include a theologian and an ethicist as part of their visioning and the culture of the delivery of their health care. Dr. Gerald Winslow first came to my attention when he was a member of the Council on the Christian View of Human Life. That committee drew together scholars from a wide variety of backgrounds and produced for the church a series of documents which, though they are getting a little old, still are recognized as being outstanding documents on some extremely sensitive issues. It may be that in the wisdom of the World Church, they will see a time when there is a need to reconvene that council to perhaps review and update some of the statements that have already been made. Nevertheless, Dr. Winslow was a very important member of that committee. You can view his work by visiting the health websites. When we talk about websites, at the moment the Health Ministry's website is called Health20-20. But we are changing that, and we have just set up healthministries.com. Healthministries.com is the new website and is the website on which you will find this conference in due course. But I would like to welcome Dr. Gerald Winslow.
First, I want to begin with a word of gratitude to the organizers of the conference, Dr. Handysides and his team, and also a special word of thanks to my friend Ted Karp, who has worked so hard and so courageously to bring this conference about. I've come to appreciate his writings and also his friendship over the last time that we've gotten acquainted here. And thank you, Ted. We understand the honor, and we understand at least dimly the responsibility. Thank you for both. I'm also grateful because last week I spent the entire week hiking in the Alps above Interlaken, taking pictures like this one. And Roger Ulrich, who studies the effect of natural environment on health, says in his research there at Texas A&M that just looking at a picture like this will actually improve your health and your healing. So this may be the healthiest thing that happens to you all day. I want you to just look for a moment, take one of those deep cleansing breaths while the other people are getting their seats, and relax. There. Feel better? Thank you for this opportunity. I want to begin with three affirmations. The first is a statement of value. Every human being deserves to flourish as a person. That conviction is rooted in many different foundations, but for those of us who are people of faith, it's rooted in the love of God. It's rooted in the compassion that has been shown to us. There are other ways to come to this conviction, and we share it with many other people in the world. Every human being counts. Every human being counts for one, and nobody counts for more than one. And they all deserve to flourish. The second is a statement of fact, I believe, and that is that cultural traditions and religious practices often affect human health, sometimes for the better, sometimes for the worse. It was my assignment, given to me by Dr. Alan Handysides, my friend and also one of my bosses, because he's on our board of trustees, to talk about barriers that are presented by culture and religion when it comes to health. My last affirmation is an ethical statement. There's an ethical responsibility to challenge cultural and religious customs that harm human health. That last one could be contentious. And it's there that I want to focus for these few minutes. What is culture? When you move to another place and you represent many different cultures coming here to Switzerland, you will notice some things. That there are shared attitudes and values, goals and practices that characterize a human community. When I went to pay for the gasoline for my rental car a couple of days ago, the young man there taking my money said, "Bonjour." And when I didn't say bonjour back, because I'm not quite sure what to say, I can say bonjour or guten tag or buongiorno, but I didn't say it immediately. And he looked at me and fixed me in his gaze and said, "Bonjour." And I got the point. Bonjour, I said. I think I was not going to be allowed to pay unless I said the proper word. And at the end, I think you're supposed to say au revoir. Merci, au revoir, right? So you learn these customs, values, practices, and what they do is they create a common identity about what people consider to be normal. What is normal in a culture? Cultures are often the most powerful when they're the least noticed. You notice other people's culture when you go there, but you often don't notice yours because we swim in a culture just like fish swim in water, and most of the time fish probably don't notice water, just like you probably most of the time don't notice air, unless you live where I do, in Southern California, then you may notice it. Culture is most powerful when you don't pay attention to it. It's just the normal thing to do. So much for culture. What's religion? Any definition of religion probably already gives some indication as to what people's beliefs are. I say that religion is the stories, the rituals, the beliefs, the practices through which human beings relate to what they consider sacred or transcendent or eternal. There are many different kinds of religion, of course, in the world. And religion traditionally has been the most powerful way to sustain a culture. If you look at the great founding sociologists like the Frenchman Emile Durkheim or the German Max Weber, they were preoccupied with religion because they could see how powerful it was in creating the social reality around them. This has long been the case. Today, we have a much keener understanding of the world religions that are on our planet. And Houston Smith, one of my professors at Berkeley, says that when historians look back at our time, they won't remember it for space travel or nuclear energy so much as the time when the peoples of the world first came to take each other seriously. That may be part of what's happening even in this conference. Because one of the things that the Adventist Community of Faith does is bring people together from around the world on a regular basis. And there we must learn to talk with each other, and here in this conference, learn to talk with people who have quite a different language at WHO. I had to learn all kinds of alphabet last night. I was making my own little glossary, actually, in the talks. I have it, Ted, in case you need it. Yeah. Let's see. This was working beautifully, and now it's not. Let's get rid of this. Now I'll need your help. Oh. Okay, now it started working again. Okay, thank you. Worldwide, the world is surprisingly religious. You can get some sense of the different distribution of religions here statistically. About a third of the population of the world Christian. Well over a billion people are Muslims. And only about 16% of the world finds itself religiously unaligned, but even half of those people say that they're theistic. So only a small percentage of the world would really claim to be atheist, and many of them inhabit institutions like the university we're in here. That's why it sometimes seems like there's so many. The culture that I live in is becoming increasingly multi-religious. I asked one of my student assistants to go around not more than 10 minutes from my office and take pictures of different faith communities, houses of worship. And there she found a Protestant church, a Mormon temple, a storefront Jewish synagogue, a service station turned into a Buddhist temple, and a Greek Orthodox church, all within a few minutes of my office. Because America is becoming, as Diana Eck, famous scholar, has said, the most religiously diverse nation in the world. and Southern California, where I live, receives about 40% of all the immigrants who come to the United States. So we are, for example, the second largest Mexican city in the world after Mexico City. We're the second largest Filipino city in the world after Manila. And we're the second largest Korean city in the world after Seoul. We're also probably the largest city in the world for many ethnic groups, such as Armenians, the Hmong people, and so forth. That's Southern California. And yes, Bill, it does improve the food quality. We have more choices than McDonald's now. Be thankful. There are times when culture helps health. That's come to our attention, notably, in many different publications recently. We at Loma Linda were pleased to be featured in the National Geographic as one of those three places where people live the longest. Maybe you saw that edition that came out in November of 2005, I believe. And then a book that has become a bestseller by the same author, Dan Buettner, The Blue Zones, in which he added a community in Costa Rica. And these are the places, he said, where we can learn lessons about living longer from the people who've lived the longest. People like Marge Jatone, who there on the right, at well over 100, was still driving her luxury car through Loma Linda far too fast, to suit me, and gassing up her own car, pumping iron every day so that she could go out and help elderly people. Dan Buettner tells a story about getting in the car with Marge because she said she'd be glad to be interviewed by him, but he was going to have to go wherever she was going because she was busy. And he could ask his questions while on the move. Buettner summarizes the various elements of what it takes to be supported in a healthy culture. I won't read them for you. You can read them for yourself. But if you turn each of them into their opposite, you can see what an unhealthy culture would be, where people are inactive, eat too many calories, don't eat their vegetables, get more and more stress, don't have a spiritual life, and never participate in an extended family, to speak of. That would be an unhealthy place to live. And the evidence is you'll live a lot less long, depending on whether factors like these are present or not. So there are times when culture supports health, but there are times when culture clearly harms health. A noteworthy example that has been featured by the World Health Organizations and all kinds of non-governmental organizations around the world has been female genital mutilation. It came to light very prominently through the book Possessing the Secret of Joy, and then because of the work of supermodel Waris Deary, who wrote this article, Silent No More, about her own experience with female genital mutilation as a young girl, and said, when I imagine what happens to these little girls going through what I went through, it breaks my heart and makes me angry. I'll return to Africa and tell my story and speak out against this crime. Well, Waris Deary is proof that not everybody has fallen for the fashionable relativism of our age. You know what I'm talking about. It's that ism that says that all ethical convictions are merely social inventions. Ethical norms are determined entirely by a culture. There's no basis for evaluating the values of any culture. If people say they have a certain belief, who are you to say otherwise? And no ethical principles that apply to all cultures. This is supposed to be a progressive point of view, but think about it for a moment. It would be the most wooden, hidebound, reactionary point of view because you could never change anything. There would be no basis on which you could offer a criticism for change because it says things are the way they are and who are you to challenge them? Waris Deary says, no, I will go back, speak prophetically, and challenge. I believe that she's courageous in doing that. Because relativism does not equal respect. We don't respect a culture just because we say, well, whatever you say is right. We respect it when we engage it in conversation about the basic values, ours and whatever the culture we're engaging. So WHO, in concert with other agencies, has confirmed a commitment to support governments, communities, and the women and girls concerned to achieve the abandonment of female genital mutilation within a generation. That was a 2008 WHO document. And the goal is to be largely achieved, we might hope, by 2015. Now, my experience with culture is that it's very sturdy and changes only slowly. So I don't know what 2015 will bring, But I know that Waris Dirie's beautiful smile will be even more beautiful if we have worked toward eliminating this mutilation of children. It will be a process, as the WHO statement says, of positive social change at the community level. I would want to ask my fellow Adventist leaders in the audience what it is you're planning to do about this. What is your plan? Because as Bill Robertson said, if you don't have a plan, you won't know whether you got to where you were hoping to go or not. Let me just back up for just a moment and just say that I think one of the reasons that WHO is so committed to human rights is because, along with the United Nations, it was born in the wake of World War II. And in World War II, we saw how far a culture could go to destroy health in the name of doing medical science research. Here are the lab notes from a lab book of a medical researcher at Dachau. A continuous experiment simulating high altitude, a height of 12 kilometers on a 37-year-old Jew in good general condition, breathing up to 30 minutes, and about a half hour after the breathing stopped, dissection was started. This is a picture of that person being subjected to this high altitude simulation. It was all done in the name of medical science. Because at that time, the public health organizations of Germany had bought a new notion of Rassenhygiene. And the German speakers here will know what that means. Race hygiene. So it was a public health effort to rid the society first of those people who had lives unworthy of life, and then extending that out to larger and larger numbers. It was in the wake of Dachau and other similar times that we began to get clearer statements of human rights. Because, as Justice Jackson said, the chief American prosecutor, we must never forget that the record on which we judge these defendants, that is, the war criminals, is the record which history will judge us on tomorrow. If you want to read an eloquent speech, read something that probably should be read again in recent years, where Justice Jackson says, it's a dangerous thing to be the victor because we get to make the rules. But the chalice we put to their lips today is the one we'll drink from tomorrow. Worth remembering. I believe that the one reason that WHO and similar organizations are values-based and rights-based is because in the wake of this sort of thing, which Justice Jackson said was too important for human civilization to be left unaddressed, it had to be addressed. And we stayed the hand of vengeance. And we exercised justice and had a trial because we needed to know where the limits of culture would be and what all human beings could count on. The Nuremberg Code, for example, establishes one of those rights-based elements in its first rule, which says you have to get people's permission to do experiments on them. If they don't agree, you can't do them. What about when my culture harms health? This is a harder question because swimming like a fish in water, it's hard to notice when one's own culture harms health, but my culture has. Maybe you have heard about the Tuskegee study, or maybe you haven't, but starting in the 1930s, 400 African-American males were left untreated for syphilis. It was said by our United States Public Health Service, provided an unusual opportunity to study untreated syphilitic patients from the beginning of the disease to the death of the infected person. That study was conducted for nearly 40 years, all the way through the time of the Nuremberg trials, and even after penicillin became available to treat the disease. It was finally stopped in 1972. And President Clinton apologized 25 years later in 1997. Just one example of how a culture can harm people's health, and it's usually rooted in disrespect for the different other. The failure to recognize that all human beings deserve to flourish as persons. The value of life and the appreciation of that gift. In the apology, President Clinton said, "The people who ran the study abandoned the most basic ethical precepts. They forgot their pledge to heal and repair. They had the power to heal, They didn't. Now all we can do is apologize. And one of those first victims, now in his 90s, was still alive to hear the apology. My culture also harms in other ways. The Marlboro Man was a new ad campaign in the 40s because they had used soldiers in the past, but with the war ending, they needed a new macho image for smoking. And so they found cowboys to do this. And they're still finding, this is a recent movie where Marlboro is still being featured as part of the movie ads. What they didn't tell us very often is that Don McLaren, who was their chief star in their ad campaign, their model and a cowboy, died of lung cancer at the age of 51. And two other Marlboro men in their ad campaign also died untimely deaths of lung cancer. That was not advertised. And then there's this picture. You may not know this in your culture, but those who come from my home culture will know this. This is Joe Camel. And a recent survey shows that children in my society know Joe Campbell better than Mickey Mouse. More of them can recognize this. Why does Camel Cigarettes want to use something that's primarily attractive to children? Because as WHO has pointed out, more than 80,000 children begin smoking every day. I was 8 years old when I started smoking. And that was not unusual for the working class environment that I grew up in. Joe Camel has recently been stopped because of public outrage. And part of that came to light when we discovered a Philip Morris Tobacco Company memo, now infamous, that said, "Today's teenager is tomorrow's potential regular customer." You see, the tobacco industry has a problem in that they kill about 300,000 or 400,000 people in my society every year, so they have to find a lot of new customers. And now, when that's become harder in my society, they've begun to export this worldwide with government subsidies, I'm sorry to tell you. There are times when religion helps as well, and that has become better known in recent years, time when religion can help with health. And those, a little advertisement, forgive me, Alan, but if you want to talk more about this subject, come to seminar number 15 when you have an opportunity. This is what we'll talk about. In the popular press, people are recognizing this more and more as well. However, as one of the best researchers in this area has pointed out, scholars who study the phenomenon of religion in relationship to health often view it from a distance as if it were one thing. They don't differentiate toxic religion much from helpful religion. So, as Pargamon says, when you look at the moon from a 250,000 miles, it looks pretty smooth. When you get close, you see the differences. There's helpful religious coping, and there's unhelpful religious coping. And Pargamon, starting in over a decade ago, began to differentiate these. And in a more recent book, The Psychology of Religion and Coping, he's pointed out that positive religious coping has the support of a faith community, sees God as collaborating or cooperating in the relationship, views God as loving and close, and sees the confession of sins and the acceptance of forgiveness as very real. Amazing grace, as we sang about it this morning. This will lead to quicker healing and greater health. But there is toxic religion. And I would just ask those of you who are members of a faith community, most all of you here in this room, can you think of any toxic examples in your own faith? What Pargamon finds is that, and this is based on his empirical work, is that spiritual discontent and guilt focus on the demonic and the evil forces, passive acceptance of your destiny, and a view of God as a punisher, distant and uncaring, will actually lead people to die sooner and be unhealthy. Well, there are times then when religion does hurt. I've seen it in the clinical setting. It can lead to refusal of standard care sometimes. It can lead to demands for non-standard care. And sometimes it leads to detrimental expectations of miracles rather than seeing our role in collaborating with God for health. One case of a gypsy patient comes to mind, just to illustrate all of this. You know the Roma people probably around the world. You'll find them. I've seen them in many different countries. And they are characterized by many common customs that they take with them wherever they go in the world. And we had a patient who came to us at Loma Linda, as we often do from many different cultural groups, in her 30s with abdominal pain. She was accompanied by 30 family members. And a chieftain who said to the MD, if she dies, you better dig your grave right next to hers. Her condition deteriorated. She had undiagnosed cancer. She went into multiple organ failure. And it was clear to us she was not going to survive. And then the chieftain said, if she's going to die, you must take out all of the tubes immediately, because if she dies with holes in her body, then her soul will escape. Now, that doesn't have to be our belief, but somehow we have to figure out a way to provide whole person care in that environment. So we sought a compromise. We waited until the heart stopped, very quickly declared death, removed all the tubes, did something we don't normally do, and sewed up all the holes, and then they were satisfied. They had been respected. See, it's not just about our beliefs. It's about being respectful of others. My bumper sticker version of it is, be fully enthusiastic about your faith, but respectful of everyone else's. What we want in the end is to provide whole person care. That's our goal at Loma Linda. I think it's your goal throughout the world, no matter what area of health care you're working in. Just a cautionary note, because it is probably true that religion, while it can have many life-affirming elements, has, as the author of this recent book, Charles Kimball, I should give him credit, has recently said, at the same time we can identify corrupting influences that lead to evil and violence in all religious traditions. That's just a note of humility to think about. We've been trying to rehabilitate a hospital in Kabul, for example. Our university has been. And you see pictures that you might never expect to see in life. No weapons allowed in the hospital. You also see scenes that you wish you didn't see, like little children with both legs blown away. This is our CEO, Dr. Hart, our president of our organization in Loma Linda, who cares a great deal and has a heart for these children. I want to say to all of you who are leaders that you have responsibilities leaving this conference. You should envision a healthful culture in which every human being can flourish as a whole person, body, mind, and spirit in a community. You should express that vision in winsome ways, and you should use collaborative leadership skills to guide an effective cultural change. You know, the book that many of us accept as holy says, where there's no vision, the people perish. Well, take another one of those deep cleansing breaths. This from the Alps last week. And think about this pathway I was walking. Think of it as a pathway to a healthful culture that will require your best courage and skills to lead change. And thank you so much for this opportunity.